This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 213, was recorded on April 2nd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by my own vacation rental on the coast of Maine, which I'm repurposing as a COVID-19 safe haven for a family that wants to escape city life for a few months during this crisis. The house is available right now, and I'll tell you about it later on. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all over the world who, without a doubt, are the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. Last week, we were treated to infinite monetary policy accommodation in the form of unlimited quantitative easing at the pace of $625 billion per week, plus a $2 trillion fiscal stimulus bill. Just when everybody thought surely it was over, this week, President Trump suggested another $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus, this time in the form of a massive infrastructure spending initiative. Should we expect the new normal to include $2 trillion per week of new fiscal stimulus in addition to unlimited monetary stimulus going forward? Well, one thing's certain, and that is that the government's actions are going to debase the value of fiat currency. So the long-term fundamentals for precious metals couldn't look much better. Who could be a better feature interview guest than Josh Crum on such an occasion? Josh headed up the Precious Metals Research Group for Goldman Sachs before moving on to found Gold Money. And he's currently involved in launching a new Singapore-based commodity exchange. We'll discuss the gold-oil ratio, pricing models for gold relative to both crude oil and real interest rates, and we'll talk about what lies ahead for precious metals from here. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment, when we'll discuss why buying what seems like a generational low in oil prices isn't really the trade it might appear to be. We'll explain contango, super contango, and roll-forward premia in futures markets, and we'll explain why you can get stuck with the same underperformance in long crude oil trades, regardless of whether you trade through futures or an ETF. We'll also have an update on the coronavirus crisis. I'd like to once again thank everyone who's donated to make additional content possible during this crisis. We couldn't produce any extra episodes this week, but we're working on two for next week. First, by popular request, we'll have a crude oil special with Art Berman, and then we're going to do an expanded special on the mechanics of the gold market, going into much more depth in the discussion that we had in last week's market wrap about physical product premiums and some of the things that I discussed in the market wrap last week, which we got a lot of questions and comments on.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, we're going to adjust our show format starting with this week's episode in order to keep the length of the market wrap under control. We're moving our COVID-19 coronavirus update to the post-game segment at the end of the podcast so we can give the subject the time it deserves without turning our 15-minute market wrap into an hour-long affair. So now, Eric, let's dive right into it. The S&P 500 has more or less muddled all week long. What's your take? Are we still going higher here on the short term, or is it a very bearish scenario in your mind here?
Well, as we'll discuss later in postgame, the worst of the virus news is still to come. I think that the bottom is not yet in for the market. A lot of other smart people, Jeff Gundlach, Jim Rogers, have been coming out publicly saying the bottom is not in yet, much lower to go. The virus was just the pin that popped the bubble and so forth. Now, if you want to know the most bearish scenario that I can think of, well, let's start with the 33.98 top in the S&P. We went very quickly all the way down to 2174. And then we got, you know, the 38.2% Fib retracement would have taken us up to 2642. We got to 2635. I'm going to call that close enough. Let's say that that was the top of a bear market rally and it's downhill from here. Well, if we apply a measured move to that 2635, the target is 1411 on the S&P. Now, that frankly sounds too low even for my bearish taste. I would think the 1550 highs from 2007 would provide pretty formidable support. So I do think that numbers in the teens, maybe high teens, are possible in the S&P in the next month or two. The thing is, if we were still in the pre-2008 market normal, where markets were driven by economic fundamentals, I'd say, okay, I think it's very likely that we go well below 2000 here. The thing is, today, we've got the government spending trillions of dollars per week, like money's going out of style. And the Fed has very clearly signaled that they want to be able to buy stocks, even though that's not allowed by the Federal Reserve Act. Currently, they seem to be trying to figure out a way to make it happen. So, you know, if you've got an unlimited amount of money coming off the printing press and you want to support asset markets, you can do just about anything. So I don't think anything is certain here. I don't have that strong of a bearish conviction simply because I don't know what's going to happen in terms of government intervention. Absent such intervention, I would say 1550 to 1700 is probably where we're headed from here. I'm still short for now, but again, as I say, I don't have really strong speculation in terms of how to trade this crisis. Other trades like short oil have played out much better. Well, maybe until today. We'll talk about that in just a minute.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar because we have a euro that's weakening quite a bit, but not all the currencies have reversed. Do you think the dollar's going higher from here?
I think so. It seems to me that a pattern is emerging. You know, the Fed prints insane amounts of U.S. dollars. The Fed does some kind of extremely accommodative thing. The market says, oh my gosh, surely this has to be the end. You know, it's got to be the end for the dollar. This has got to be the final high. It's all downhill from here. The market knee-jerks down in reaction to that news, but then reality sits in and people realize, wait a minute, this crisis is dollar positive. People all around the world are raising dollars to service their dollar-denominated debts. There's a safety trade into dollars, and there's lots of reasons to expect more dollar strength. Goldman Sachs agrees with that view. They've been saying to expect a disorderly dollar appreciation from here. So clearly, the big test is a daily close, or better yet, a weekly close above 104 on the dollar index. That's still way above us. But hey, we're back over 100 now, so it looks to me like we're on the way. The big test is 104.
All right, so let's move on to crude oil because everything looked like it was just going downwards, and then we got the big news. Is this reversal for real?
I don't think so. What a day, Patrick, in the crude oil market today. But let's take this in order and cover the other stuff that happened earlier in the week first, and we'll come back to today's crazy action. WTI found strong round number support right at $20 a barrel two solid weeks ago on the 18th of March. And there's only been a few brief dips to a 19 handle. No closes below, with the one exception of the last day, just as the April contract was expiring. That doesn't really count because by then it's no longer the actively traded contract. So in terms of what the active contract was, we haven't closed below 20 bucks yet. My prediction had been that what the market needed to see was these expectations everyone has about a storage crisis being confirmed by EIA data, really big inventory builds. Well, we got that this week. Crude oil building 13.8 million barrels. It's the biggest one since, I don't know, 2000-something. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 3.5 million barrels. Gasoline, building 7.5 million barrels. Distillates was the only drawdown on the board at 2.2 million barrels. U.S. production still holding strong, at least according to the data, at 13 million barrels. Kind of hard for me to believe that nobody's cut back production at all during this crisis, so I really suspect that data. But the thing is, as much as I thought that that confirmation was going to be what was needed for the price to move lower, we got a whole flurry of news coming out at the same time, just after the inventory data, which I'm sure was no coincidence. Trump announced that he was going to meet on Friday with the CEOs of several oil companies, talk about maybe a Saudi tariff, some way to support the industry, and was suggesting or implying that Saudi Arabia and Russia were close to resolving their differences. Then Wednesday night, we got more news, which was China has plans to fill its strategic petroleum reserve that could consume up to 100 million barrels in total over the next couple of months. That got us back to the 13-day moving average by Thursday morning. Unemployment claims put a damper on that. We were headed straight down. And then whammo, the President Trump tweet from beyond. President Trump announced that there was going to be a 10 to 15 million barrel per day cut in crude oil production that Saudi Arabia and Russia were apparently agreeing to. Now, the notion that anyone anywhere took that seriously for more than 30 milliseconds just defies logic. That would mean that both Saudi Arabia and Russia would have to cut their production by about two-thirds and stand by while the U.S. continues to produce full tilt. Now, consider the history here. They couldn't agree on a half million barrel additional production cut when Russia walked out of the meeting several weeks ago. So the notion that it's even plausible that they would agree to a 15 million barrel production cut is just crazy. But that's what the president tweeted. That's what the market algorithms reacted to. And we went straight up to the 21-day moving average on the continuation chart at 27 spot 40, 27. Actually, I think the last print was 27 spot 39. Wow, really big move. Tremendous opportunity for anybody who read the tweet and realized what nonsense it was to short it, which is what I think a lot of us did. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Now, it didn't take long for both Saudi Arabia and Russia to refute it, but they're being smart about it. They're not really refuting it in a confrontational way, because that would just help the oil price go back down. They just said that they think that the president's number has not been agreed to as of this time or something, and then later they said it was possibly exaggerated. No kidding. It was absolute fantasy. So I don't know what the president is smoking. That there's not going to be a 15 million barrel production cut. Finally, when they announced this afternoon that the president's number was exaggerated, it was, I believe, Saudi Arabia tweeted that. That allowed the market to sell off very, very sharply, back down to about $23.35. And then just before the close, seems like somebody wanted to hammer the close higher. We went $2 straight up in the last 15 minutes of trading. That happens a lot on the end of the quarter or sometimes the end of the month when somebody is trying to force the price higher in order to get their accounting for the month to look better or something. It's very unusual to see it on the second day of the month that somebody's trying that hard to monkey hammer the price higher. I'm pretty sure that there was no news for it. It's just somebody really wanted to push the closing number higher and was buying like crazy for the last 10 minutes or so. So it seems like there's a lot going on in this market, a lot of attempts to manipulate it higher. I don't think that there's any reality to this nonsense of a 10 to 15 million barrel production cut. What Saudi Arabia has said is exactly consistent with everything they've said before. They were happy to have a meeting to talk about this, but they're not going to cut unless everybody else cuts. And so far, nobody else was willing to cut half a million barrels, never mind 15 million barrels. It remains to be seen what the president tweets tomorrow. But so far, you know, it's despite all of this, we closed up $5 on the day, even though anyone who really understands the market understands there's no way that what the president described is actually going to happen. So as much as it may not be based on reality, it's working at pumping the price higher.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold's been pulling back for most of the week. And then today we have a pretty big up day, close to $50, and pretty much undid the last few days of selling. Really feels like gold wants to press that 52-week high. Do you think that it's going to break out this time around?
You know, it seems like what's going on is when we have a really aggressive selling going on in the stock market, that phenomenon I've described kicks in and it pulls the price down. But as soon as you get any other kind of news, gold's just looking for an excuse to rally. So the idea of getting back down to 1350 based on stock market weakness, I don't see that happening anymore. I don't know where it goes from here, frankly. I think there's still reason to expect a lot of volatility. But hey, that's why we've got Josh Crum on this week's feature interview. Josh is a much heavier weight gold guy than I am. He's got a lot to say about this. He models gold not only on real interest rates, as do a lot of other people, but he has a model that uses both real interest rates and oil prices. So we'll talk about how oil prices and what comes next in the oil market is going to play into the gold market. That's all coming up in the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, which continued to deteriorate. I mean, we're a little bit up today, but I mean, we were trading at spot 6.0 earlier. Do you think interest rates just keep weakening here?
You know, I had thought that before, but then we've seen all of this volatility recently, and I don't mind admitting that a lot of it caught me by surprise. As I've said before, the really big burning question in my mind is I know someday we're going to get to the point where stocks and bonds sell off together and interest rates back up in a secular fashion. A lot of people on Twitter seem to think that I've predicted that on the show. I never said that, folks. What I've said is that's the important thing to watch for. That will happen someday. When it does, watch out, because the implications are staggering in terms of what the knock-on effects could be. I'm not saying that's happening now. I don't know if it's happening now. At the moment, it looks like it's not, but I think we really need to watch it carefully. This is beyond my pay grade, frankly. We need to get some more guests, Dr. Lacey Hunt level people, to really get into the details of this and talk about what it would take to bring about a secular sell-off in the bond market and whether or not we're seeing signs that one's coming. I don't know the answer to that question, but I know it's the most important question to focus on in fixed income.
This week's featured interview guest is Josh Crum. Why did we invite Josh back to the show as a guest this week?
Well, Josh is just a wealth of knowledge on precious metals markets, and we're going to be focusing on bringing more and more precious metals experts. I'm also going to do a precious metals special talking about the mechanics of the market next week, because we had a lot of inquiries from my comments about some of the games that are played by the physical metal dealers, and I want to expand on that and get into it with an expert. So we're going to do an extra show on that. We're going to try to bring more precious metals oriented guests into the program, because it's such an important topic. And, you know, who better to start it with than Josh Crum, who really has a heavy background, you know, ran the precious metals research department for Goldman Sachs, went on to be a co-founder of Gold Money. Now he's working on launching a new commodity exchange, which I think is really exciting. So he's a super talented guy, a lot of background, and it's time to get more precious metal guys onto the show. And we're going to be bringing you more of them in coming weeks.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Josh Crum is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Josh Crum, who formerly was the head of precious metals research for Goldman Sachs, went on to found Gold Money, and has since gone on to found Abex Technologies. We'll talk about that at the end of the interview. But first, Josh, it's great to have you back on the show. So much to talk about with so much going on in the gold market. Josh, help me navigate the current opportunities in the gold market. And I'll just start by telling you how I see it. On one hand, I really think, first of all, when there's a panic, people rush into gold. We've kind of seen what's looking like a blow-off top. It's starting to correct lower. I think there's a really good argument that says that the stock market is not done with the downside from the COVID-19 crisis yet. What we saw in 2008, it seems like there's a lot of good reason to think it's coming back, which is correlations go to one in a crisis. Everything sells off. Even though the fundamentals for gold are improving, people are selling it to raise cash, and the price ends up going down, even when you would hope it would go up and under those circumstances. So I see lots of reasons to think that a dip is coming. But holy cow, the Fed just basically put up a buy gold sign and announced their intentions to illuminate it by spending $625 billion a week on lighting. You know, with this monetary policy intervention, it's kind of hard not to just say, okay, the fundamentals are so good, you can't wait, you just got to dive in here. Which is it, or is it a combination of both? And how do you navigate this tug of war in the gold market?
Hi, Eric. Thanks. Good to be back. One thing that I would say probably right up front is I actually don't believe so strongly in this narrative of, you know, sell everything, you know, dollar short squeeze, and this sort of view. And I'll sort of explain how I look at it, which ultimately comes out to be something similar, I would say, but there is a fundamental behind it. So when I look at gold trading markets, gold price markets, there's a couple things that are important to look at. What's the actual physical flow for gold and the gold demand, you know, call it on Main Street or the real economy? And then what's the demand for futures and just gold exposure on Wall Street? And so if you look at what the demand for gold exposure is, it's actually still extremely well correlated with real interest rate expectations. So even when we saw that spike up to 1700 in early March that, you know, subsequently collapsed very quickly to, you know, I think it was 1550 or 1525, and it was a pretty dramatic swing in the gold price, it actually still matched up extremely well with the pricing of real interest rates as seen in, say, the 10-year TIPS market. So what was happening is the dollar short squeeze wasn't just a sort of physical commodity short squeeze, you know, where you're selling everything, but also the models and people that trade the gold price futures based on, you know, metrics like real interest rate expectations and TIPS correlations. So that also happened. So that's sort of what's happening, and call it the paper, you know, paper gold market, the machines, the algorithms. So when we saw that happen, we actually very quickly saw those. So real interest rates actually went up because essentially the market was pricing deflation very, very quickly because of the zero lower bound. If you price that the world's going into a deflationary, say negative 2% inflation, negative 1% inflation, but you're trapped at that zero bound, it actually means that you have positive real interest rates, even though growth may be negative. So this is one of the hardest sort of, you know, concepts for people to think about, particularly when they're thinking about gold. And so we actually saw a very fundamental sell-off on that real interest rate spike. However, that got unwound very quickly, not just with Fed actions, but in general, you saw it across many assets. So gold rebounded very quickly back into the 1650 type of range, which is actually very well predicted by the model that I actually, you know, helped develop. And Gold Money Research put out an update to that model back in June of last year, you know, where basically 1650 was the sort of target price back when it was 1300. So, you know, despite all the craziness, the model is actually holding up extremely well. And for anyone that's interested, you know, I do have those models and that research pinned to my Twitter profile right now, you know, because I try to keep that information, you know, front and center. Because again, there's a lot of narrative, there's a lot of talking about, you know, fear and dollar short squeezes and all of these things. But I think it's important to always have it still in a real fundamental model. And basically what's happening is this fundamental uncertainty is actually quite significant. We don't know if we're going to have negative 2% inflation or if we're going to have, you know, plus 2% inflation. So that uncertainty, that window is actually quite fundamental. And I don't think there's anybody that has a perfect model with for where we're headed. So again, that volatility, I think, is fundamentally going to remain for a long time. But, you know, in my view in general, I think it's very dangerous to play this game of, you know, I'm just going to wait for a dip. Now, if you see a dip, buy it, in my view. So, sorry, in the model's view, I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to make short-term trading recommendations because that's never been my framework. But it's really just to help people understand why prices are moving where they are and what that macro framework, you know, looks like in the future. So I'm not making short-term advice, but I do think that this dollar short squeeze narrative is overstated, in my view.
Now, when I read a recent Twitter thread that you posted, it sounds like your model actually is predicting a fairly wide range of possible prices. Is that because of uncertain expectations around interest rates or inflation or both or other factors? And what is that range in terms of what you see as being possible for the gold market in coming weeks?
Exactly. So, you know, again, I just sort of, I'm not sure how well I explained it, but, you know, part of is the real interest rate portion. And this, again, is very important because this is the way Wall Street trades gold. And it's basically trades it like a currency cross, right? So real interest rate models and interest rate differentials are also the way, you know, that Wall Street trades, you know, say the euro versus the dollar. So essentially what's happening there when you're pricing real interest rates, you're pricing the demand for gold as a basically a neutral or a zero carry foreign exchange, right? So if it costs money to carry currency, people would rather be in gold than, you know, paying a negative real interest rate on, you know, holding currency. So again, this range is very uncertain right now because, you know, yet again, we're in this huge dilemma. Are we going to have inflation or deflation? Is it going to be short-term deflation followed by long-term inflation? There really is a very wide range in that. Now, the other factor that plays heavily into our model, which differentiates us from probably just about all the other models out there, and particularly on Wall Street, is we also have an energy component to our gold price framework. And so when I talk about real interest rates, we're really talking about the demand for gold as a money stock or as an alternative currency. Again, when other currencies are having a negative real carry. So that's more of a demand for gold type issue. On the supply side, energy is your key component. This determines the marginal cost of gold and really the fundamental sort of anchor price of how we create new supply of gold. Because gold is so energy intensive to produce, it's got a very high energy correlation. And when I say that, I'm not looking at the front month, you know, $20 a barrel of oil. I'm actually looking at the long-dated energy futures and the expectation of really what marginal cost of gold is. And if you look at the forward curve of oil, we're still in the sort of $50 a barrel range. And again, we can get into the oil dynamic later if we want. But essentially, the model is pricing real interest rate expectations and energy price expectations. So those are the two big components to the model. And so again, going back to your question of how, you know, how big that window is, that range is actually quite incredible, right? Because we don't know, you know, just 6 months ago, long-dated energy futures were around $70 a barrel. Now they've, you know, just like the front month, that's collapsed to about $50 a barrel. I mean, obviously not extreme as going from $60 in the front month down to 20, but we still have relatively, you know, we still believe we need oil in the future, right? This is a temporary supply glut. But the uncertainty is, do we really create such a economic depression that you know, the oil price curve keeps shifting down? That would be negative for gold. And if we enter a deep recessionary environment, that would also be negative for gold. So basically what you have is you've got this window of, you know, 1200 on one side, you know, based on those two factors, and 2100 on the other, which is just an incredible, and it sounds like an analyst cop-out to have such a wide range. But again, based on our model, that window is that big. And that's actually very consistent in a lot of other markets if an analyst is being honest. You know, we have such a fundamental uncertainty right now of what comes out the other side that we're just going to have this heightened volatility for a long, long time, in my view.
Let's go a little bit deeper on this subject of the gold oil ratio, because it's something that, at least when most analysts look at it, they really are looking at the spot price of oil and the spot price of gold. And I think we're already either close to or at an all-time record on the gold oil ratio in terms of, you know, dollars per barrel of oil to dollars per ounce of gold. I think it's going to go much farther than it has already, but it's all about what happens in the front month. I think what we're about to see is an all-time record super contango in the oil market, where right now we're at about $46 for long-dated futures, you know, 8-9 years out into the future. If I look at today's spot market or front month futures price, we're right on $20, just barely above 20 as we're recording on Tuesday morning. I think we're headed much lower, maybe as low as $10 on the front month futures price. But if that happens, it's going to happen in a super contango condition where still, if you go 2 or 3 years out on the curve, you're back up over $35. So with that outlook, does that mean that in the short term, gold prices get pulled way down with it? Or is this function of energy in your model operate in a way where it's almost immune to that super contango condition and really only discounts the later dated futures?
That's a great question, Eric, and one that I've been fielding a lot, because, you know, I think as our energy gold framework has been, you know, picking up more steam in the market, a lot of people have been reaching out exactly on that point. And I think you're right. So first, a couple numbers around the front month oil to gold ratio, because that's the one that generally gets posted, you know, on Twitter and, you know, in the general macro sphere. And it is quite incredible what's happened. So, you know, generally the last, you know, 30, 40 years, the oil to gold ratio, you're looking at somewhere between, it's a pretty wide window, again, for the reasons of the backwardation and contango in oil markets. But generally, it's ranged between 10 barrels per ounce to 30 barrels per ounce, with the average right around 20. So you actually have this pretty neat, you know, clean range for gold over oil. And that, by the way, is not just a modern phenomenon. If I look back in the 1920s and 1930s, at the height of the Roaring Twenties, you had oil at around $1.90 a barrel, which translates and gold, you know, the fixed 20.67 per ounce, and so you're around $10, $10-$11, and then in the, you know, in 1931, it's sort of the, you know, in the market collapse, we moved up to about 30. So again, we stayed in that 10 to 30 range, and we've always been in that sort of 10 to 30 range. So where are we today? We're over 70. So this is really an unprecedented collapse in oil prices, you know, measured to something like gold. And so we're just way off the charts at this point. But again, back to your point, and if I look at what's happening in our price model and in the gold market, again, it's still pricing that long-dated future. Now, I think you said 46. You must be using WTI. I think I usually use Brent in my model, but essentially similar mechanics. You know, I think the Brent price is 48, 49, something like that, at least when I looked at it a week or so ago. And so yeah, we still believe gold is pricing that expectation, right? Because gold, in our view, prices like a money stock. It prices like a currency, or it prices like a 10-year TIPS. So that's the way that we look at gold, and it's that framework seems to be holding up. So it has not been directly impacted by the collapse in front month prices. It's still looking at expected values of currency and energy, right, in, you know, perfectly in line with our model so far.
So would it be fair to say then that your opinion is that even though most people look at the spot gold oil ratio, what would make more sense would be to divide the spot price of gold by the back end of the futures curve, whatever the longest dated futures are pricing at, which right now is 47 spot 37 on WTI, and it sounds like 48 something on Brent. Is that the model? Is use the back end of the curve?
Exactly. It's the back end of the curve. And why is this? Because this is actually where you're getting industrial price signals into the market, is through forward hedging, not necessarily on spot, you know, spot market hedging or flows. Spot markets, whether you're talking about gold or you're talking about oil, are all about actually what the current inventory and current supply chains are needing as sort of a buyer and seller of last resort market. So the front end of the curve really has to do really only with what inventories are and what, you know, very near-term spot markets are doing. But again, if I'm a, whether I'm a mining company that's hedging or I'm an oil company that's hedging, that price information about our real marginal cost is coming into the futures curve, not into the forward price. So yeah, not into the near dated futures. So that's why we look at the futures curve. And again, it holds up very well in our model.
Now, Josh, you just said something that really caught my attention, because a minute ago we were talking about the back end of the curve. That's 8 or 9 years out into the future. But what you just said is the important economic signal comes from where people are hedging, where producers are hedging their forward production. As I understand, at least the U.S. shale industry, that's normally about 2 years out on the curve. And if I look 2 years out on the WTI curve, I see the March of 22 contract trading at 38.74. So that's almost $10 lower than the number we were talking about at the back end of the curve. Which one of these is actually the relevant signal to use?
No, it's a great question, and one that I'd say the whole industry is struggling with a little bit, and particularly some of the frameworks we developed at Goldman. And there's a couple reasons why this is happening. First off, the balance sheets of the banks and what they could actually take as far as inventory for these types of hedges. The world has changed significantly since, you know, 2009 and a lot of the bank reforms. And similar dynamic you've heard in, you know, bond markets and the destocking of inventory of bonds on bank balance sheets. Same thing when you're talking about gold. We can get back to gold, talking about how the whole dealer inventory has been destocked significantly. Same thing with you know, long-dated futures. So what's happening currently in this curve is a lot of these shale producers in particular have just been dumping, just selling and selling and selling, you know, sort of that midterm future, exactly as you pointed out. So we think that that longer term price signal has been lost a little bit in the market, very much like an illiquid bond might lose its pricing signal. But, you know, fundamentally, we still believe that marginal costs are really anchored in expected marginal costs, right? You don't build a new project and create new swings in supply, you know, based on what the near-term price is. It's always about expectations. So, you know, that's where the actual industry, you know, practical application is sort of running into theory at the moment. But ultimately, you know, we still believe that it's the expected marginal cost that matters for producers to make production decisions, not just the spot price.
Okay, Josh, so if we look at where the spot gold oil ratio is, which you said is the number that probably doesn't make that much sense to pay attention to, but what everybody looks at, it's like 70 barrels per ounce. And just based on the conversation that we've had, if I look at the 2 year out where the shale hedgers are hedging, and I use that number, I get about 42 barrels per ounce. And if I use the very back end of the curve, I get about 34 barrels per ounce. That's still beyond the 30 barrel top end of the range. So it seems like no matter how you slice it, we're looking at what could be considered a situation where oil prices are putting a drag on gold prices, or perhaps artificially constraining the gold price. Is that true? Is that what's holding gold back from responding to what seems to me like an incredibly bullish impetus from central bank policy action in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I actually think that's I hadn't run those numbers myself, and I actually think that's extremely helpful. And I agree. You know, we're still in this, you know, very unprecedented sort of expensive gold relative to the other sort of commodity economy. And our view is that gold has always been a money that sort of stays even, right? So when you get these sort of spikes above even, you know, it could be a short-term squeeze or a short-term sort of rush for gold. And you can also see that in something like, you know, the copper market or platinum or silver. So we do seem to be having this sort of run to gold that seems excessive compared to some of the other metals and commodities. And so, yeah, that would give me some pause on chasing a gold price here. Now, again, that said, I still believe all of those commodities that I mentioned are going to be, you know, are likely to be much higher a year, 2 years out because of inflationary reasons. But it's never good to chase a squeeze either.
I want to move on to another topic that's gotten us a huge number of questions and inquiries from listeners, which is the physical disruptions in the gold market. To be sure, the coronavirus crisis has brought about physical disruptions. It's difficult to take delivery of physical gold on the LBMA. There's been some disruptions in the COMEX. Something I've noticed over decades of following precious metals is any time that there's any real physical disruption in the market, that also leads to imagined physical disruptions where the precious metals dealers, particularly the guys that are selling retail-sized bars and coins, start publishing articles about how the world is coming to an end. The paper markets are collapsing. You better rush and just pay whatever premium you have to get those physical gold eagles in your hand, because the entire COMEX LBMA, it's all going out of business next week. Help us navigate, or help our listeners navigate, okay, what's really happening? What are the real physical dislocations in the market? What do they look like? And what are some of the things that we should not be taking seriously in terms of inflated predictions and descriptions that some people have put forth?
Yeah, I generally agree with your statement on that, that it gets exaggerated. Yes, in very short term, rush for silver or gold, you do lose retail dealer inventory. And that's because, you still have to mint it, and all of the supply chain that goes into the mint, into the distributors, into the retail dealers, into the U.S. Postal Service, all of that, that's a real supply chain. And just like any other supply chain, the surges of supply and demand, it's very hard to manage that. So that is real. I wouldn't understate that these shortages are real. And I would say what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a pretty much just an epic, just like this oil gold ratio blowing out so significantly. We're also seeing that in real physical inventories. So, if I look at something like silver coins, that one usually happens first. Again, that's very real because it's a sort of a high cost to carry, commodity. There's not a lot of inventories of silver coins, even in the best of times. But when we actually get that kind of squeeze on, say, kilo bars in the gold market, or 100-ounce bars, 400-ounce bars, that's really the wholesale level. And that's pretty extreme. We have not seen that before. So what we saw last week with even my former company, Gold Money, which holds about $2 billion worth of client metal, and again, operating at a much higher scale than, say, a coin dealer, there was an absolute shortage of kilo bars. There was absolute shortage of kilo bars in New York, in Switzerland, in Singapore. So this is real. Now, is that just an issue of very short-term transportation and, moving inventories around because of coronavirus shut-ins? Likely. But that said, we have, as I alluded to earlier, we really have destocked, even investment grade bullion over the last 10 years from dealer inventories. And the financing for the people the wholesalers, the financing has been getting tighter and tighter and more difficult to come by. So I believe that squeeze is real. I believe those shortages are real. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't gold in the LBMA vaults, or there isn't gold in Fort Knox or something like that, right? But the ability for somebody to give that up is becoming more and more severe. So even if that gold's sitting there, it may need a much higher premium to clear. So I would caution that I'm generally in your camp, that it's usually oversold by the dealers, but this one does seem quite different than past squeezes.
Okay, I want to draw a distinction. One of the things that I think we can agree is happening here is clearly there is a premium for retail-sized coins and bars. So whether it's a 1 ounce bar or a 1 ounce coin or even a kilo bar, which is probably the biggest, the top end of the retail spectrum in terms of size, there's clearly a shortage of that stuff that creates a premium, and the price of those retail-sized physical products is higher than the wholesale price for physical metal. No doubt about that. But what this has led to is a lot of commentary that supposedly the physical price of gold has decoupled from the paper price of gold. And usually the way the narrative goes is this decoupling is going to continue. The paper price of gold is a fantasy. You'll never be able to actually get physical metal and so forth. And I just don't think that that's true, Josh. I think what's really going on is the paper price of gold is still an accurate reflection of the wholesale price of London good delivery bars, 400 ounce bars, with the caveat that there may be a delay in taking physical possession of them because of this crisis. But I don't perceive any truth to a disconnect or a breakdown between the paper price of gold and the physical price of gold if we're talking about the physical price as measured by the wholesale market for 400 ounce bars. Am I missing anything there? Is there really a disconnect that's forming between paper and physical that I'm missing somehow?
Not necessarily. I mean, I tend to side, you know, towards your view, but that said, I wouldn't say that there's absolutely no shortage. Again, there's a shortage at 1650 or 1620. Now, would there be a shortage at 2200? That's a very different story. I do believe that we have seen unprecedented shortages, again, in places like New York and Switzerland and Singapore, that it still seems a little odd that more gold's not leaving those LBMA vaults and basically feeding some of the largest markets in the world. That to me doesn't add up. So I'd be careful to say that there's plenty of gold, because at this price there is not plenty of gold. That's, you know, that's what we're seeing. Even if you look at the current spread on COMEX, you're looking at the April to June spread. I think we're still running at a $25 backwardation, and even that whole term structure is higher than the LBMA price. So the market's still pricing all the way out to June and in the April June spread that there's a shortage of wholesale, you know, financial bullion. So again, I would be a little bit careful to say that there's plenty of gold, because we would have seen it flowing out a lot more. And another point that I would say is that this has not been happening only the last couple of weeks. This is the other thing that I think even if you're reading some of the, you know, sort of shock articles on Zero Hedge or some of these, one of the things that I can tell you is this institutional run in gold started back in Q4. So really, during the whole not QE spike and repo, you know, repo madness, that's actually when we saw the largest vault movements in LBMA and sort of London export history. So we've seen major financial gold, you know, wholesale gold leaving the system, and that's been that sort of silent bank run has been happening for you know, almost five, six months now. So that's another thing that's played into this recent short squeeze on the COMEX. So again, we're in a very different situation than 08. I don't think you can make analogies to 08, because there was so much wholesale dealer inventory. There was so much dealer, you know, bank and bullion bank inventory. There was a lot of scrap, and all of those categories have been heavily destocked the last 10 years. So again, it's very analogous to certain bond markets where it looks like you have a price until spreads really blow out, because people can't actually arrange the inventory. I'm not saying that the gold's not there, but it's in much stronger hands than it was 10 years ago during these squeezes.
Well, that's very interesting to me, because one of the things that I've been struggling with is it seems to me like we have seen in the last several weeks 2008-like price movement. And what I mean by that is, as the stock market was crashing, we saw the gold market crashing with it, even though the gold fundamentals were only getting better. And it seemed to me that that price action was confirming what I had feared, which is that correlations move to one in a crisis. And even though people don't want to sell their gold, they were being forced to sell their gold to meet margin calls or something. So it sounds like you don't think that's what was going on. How would you interpret that big move down? Was it entirely about interest rates and real interest rate expectations? And I was just maybe looking at the wrong signal when I concluded that it was about gold moving in sympathy with the stock market?
So I think it probably is a little bit of both. Again, these things have fundamental reasons and feedbacks between each other. But I still believe that it really was related to these algorithm type sell-offs with real interest rates, right? And not only that, sorry, also rising volatility. So again, that is a similar function of the dollar short squeeze, when you're having rising volatility, people's risk models and their sort of cross asset risk models say to withdraw risk, right? Take down risk. So it's not necessarily that they're short of dollars to make margin, but they're scared that they might be in the future, right? So they're taking down risk overall. And that likely happened in the tips market. So yes, that would probably be more in line with your thinking. But I'm saying it's all sort of related, and it does tie back to fundamentals. And so what we've seen is like the COMEX has been raising margin requirements on gold futures, like a lot of futures, because of the higher pricing of volatility. Again, I don't have these numbers directly in front of me, but I think gold has been trading in a 30 plus vol when it's usually down at, at 12, 15 vol. So we're still seeing heightened volatility, which means that people are trading it on margin, and in futures are going to be, less risk exposure. And so yes, that's sort of the dynamic that's been playing out. But again, I think particularly with what's happened in the COMEX and the real sort of physical wholesale dealer inventories, I'd be very surprised to see people dumping gold because they may view that they can't get it back again. So again, there's feedbacks in both the psychology and what's happening that, again, at the margin, I'm going to take down risk. I may not want to take down risk in an asset that I want, that I know I can't get back again at the same price. So I think we've set a higher floor than what we saw a few weeks ago, but that's how I would read it using that framework.
I want to move on to another topic that I know you've done a lot of work on, Josh. There's a whole new generation of investors who would listen to this entire conversation and say, guys, you're stuck in the dark ages. The new asset to think about in terms of safe haven protection is not gold. That's old school. The new thing is crypto. Where does digital currency fit into all of this? Needless to say, we haven't seen the strength in digital currency recently that some people would have expected if you thought it was going to be the new safe haven asset. What does all of this mean, and what's your outlook for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum and so forth?
First off, I'm not opposed to cryptocurrencies. I find them very interesting. I think it's been an incredible innovation in sort of the history and the technology of money, and just the narratives that are spreading through the crypto community that are actually quite in line with people in the hard money communities. I think that's generally been a good thing. That said, I do not believe that Bitcoin is digital gold. I don't believe it ever will be, based on my model of what a commodity and a proof of work of energy looks like. So again, that's a long rabbit hole to get into. But what I in general don't like is that more and more use cases have really not come to fruition, they keep sort of just anchoring back to its digital gold, and essentially they're just selling the gold narrative. Right. And that to me is quite worrisome. And when you see, price swings as we've seen in the last year, and the whole drop gold campaign, I mean, I don't know of a worse macro call that's been made than to sell gold right when it was at 1300 and about to go on its run at the same time, digital currencies collapsed. And also another point that I'd point out is usually the people that say, oh, gold, we've moved on from gold, younger generations are all digital, they always make this narrative, and they always end with the point, you're going to buy it later at a much higher price, which tells me they don't understand money. You don't look to buy money to speculate. You look to buy money to store value. And so again, like they're trying to have it both ways. They want it to be digital gold, but they also want it to be the next, Amazon or Facebook or Google, as far as, capital gains. And that's not what money is supposed to do. It's not supposed to have a high volatility capital gains. So again, I do not like the digital gold narrative, but that said, I think it's still a very interesting asset class. I think it has very important use cases. If we really get into a financial repression scenario that we may be headed down with what's happening with central banks. So again, I think there's still a commodity utility to digital assets, but it's not digital gold in my view.
I wanted to start with a cryptocurrency question before moving on to what I think is a more interesting aspect of digital currency, which is the future of sovereign digital currency. For any listeners who have not read my book, Beyond Blockchain, my outlook for several years now has been, as much as the Bitcoin guys have a novel idea, I don't think that they're going to be allowed to just take over the world's monetary systems. I think governments will continue to assert their monopoly over money. And what I've predicted was that eventually, someday, as the dollar's role as the world's global reserve currency came into more and more question, that other governments around the world, and possibly the United States itself, would develop a new digital reserve currency, a global reserve currency, which is a sovereign-issued digital currency. That's been my prediction for several years. It seems to me, Josh, first of all, I'd be curious to get your general reactions to that, but it seems to me like, okay, interesting long-term prediction, but what's going to be the impetus to actually bring around that kind of change and governments getting involved in something that radical? Well, it would have to be the U.S. dollar's reserve currency status really coming into serious question, because the dollar is at serious risk because of excessive largesse on the part of the Federal Reserve printing too much money. They just announced unlimited QE forever. Seems to me like maybe now is the time for that possibility to come into scope and for other governments to start working on a new global reserve currency, which is a digital currency. What do you think about that outlook, and what do you think the prospects are for something like that happening?
Yeah, it's very very interesting for sure, and it's funny. It kind of takes us back in time to the first time we talked. We actually got into this as well. So it's interesting how the world continues to sort of move in this direction. One interesting take that I would probably add to the discussion, because you know this is a very very tricky discussion and all the different steps that would be needed to get there. But one interesting discussion, my co-founder of Gold Money and BitGold, Roy Sabag, had a very interesting conversation with Marty Bent recently, and basically he was presenting that what the Federal Reserve did was sort of a man in the middle attack on gold, right? In the slow sort of taking gold from being a monetary asset to disintermediating it with gold certificates and Federal Reserve dollars, and eventually here we are now. What's interesting is something similar could be happening in the Bitcoin and the digital currency realm as well. So, for as much as we just spent time on, is there really gold at COMEX and LBMA, the same could very much be said about the big crypto custodians, right? A very large percentage of retail crypto is still being held at the likes of a Coinbase and a Zappo. And if you look at, and particularly since those have now merged, so if you look at developments like that, that looks very much like the LBMA system, where you have just a number of players sitting on all of the vault and in a very difficult way to go in and out. So again, I just wanted to raise that point because I think it's very interesting, and a lot of people aren't talking about it because there's a lot of people in crypto saying things like, oh, look how much of a mess the physical delivery of gold is. This is why crypto is so much better. Yeah, well, again, in theory, sure. It's much easier to transport if you know how to store your own keys. But most people aren't doing that. Most people are stuck in their LBMA-style vaults with cold storage. So just wanted to point that out. But that then leads to the next question of, as Roy presented, the Federal Reserve as a man-in-the-middle attack on gold to eventually create the completely unbacked U.S. dollar. That similar thing could happen in crypto as well, where some of these big crypto dealers really start almost partnering with the governments to create these digital currencies. And of course, we saw that developing at Libra, and we're of course seeing that developing in China. So it could be very interesting when sort of the large players in the crypto industry start merging with the central bank initiatives to drive basically fiat stable coins, but supported by the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of China, et cetera. So I think that's a path that we're likely on right now. And so again, it kind of comes back to the conversation you and I had a couple of years ago, and that seems to all be accelerating right now.
Yeah, certainly my view on this is it's going to be a different category. I think of the first generation of digital currency is cryptocurrency. That was a bunch of guys who came up with some just absolutely brilliant software engineering. And they naively thought that just because they invented something really cool that they could usurp the authority of government and create something that was government-proof. And in the end, the government still has the guns and the badges. And unfortunately, I don't think they're going to let go of their monopoly. The next thing to happen was Facebook's Libra came along, and I call it a whole different category, which I'm calling Silicon Valley digital currencies. Now, Zuckerberg got it all wrong. He didn't understand that if you want to take over the entire planet's money supply, you have to bribe all the politicians first. So he didn't do that. And as a result, he got the reaction that he got. My prediction is what happens next is Google or someone else in Silicon Valley does their own Libra, but they do it only after buying off all the politicians so that they get unanimous support rather than opposition from Congress because of a whole bunch of campaign contributions that they astutely made before introducing their new product. And I think there is scope for a Silicon Valley digital currency to become the new de facto global reserve currency. If you want to engineer something better than the US dollar in the form of a digital currency that will appeal to more central banks around the world more than the US dollar does, it's not a difficult engineering task to undertake. What we haven't yet seen is a Silicon Valley company recognize the political reality of who you have to bribe before you can pull something like that off. Zuckerberg tried to do it without bribing anybody first, and look where that got him. So that's what I think is coming next. Any comments or reactions to that?
I think you said it perfectly. I agree that that's the path. And I think, you know, as I sort of set it up with the man in the middle attack, I think that's very similar and sort of leads to that same outcome. And I agree with you. And you're right about Mark Zuckerberg, but I would say the person that has been very good at playing those sort of circles is David Marcus. David was the former CEO of PayPal. He left to join and build Messenger and try to create, you know, a WeChat or Alipay out of Facebook Messenger. His new project is Libra, and it's for all the same reasons that you just pointed out. So I would say that yes, that is ongoing in the background, and I think you're probably right. That's the path it's going to ultimately take. As you know, the Federal Reserve and a number of the governments realize they can't do this themselves. They need Silicon Valley. And I see a merger of that sort of happening as well. I think, yeah, 100% in agreement with you.
And for any listeners who are not aware, I wrote a whole book about this stuff a couple of years ago. It's called Beyond Blockchain. You can find information at macrovoices.com/BB, or just go on Amazon and look for Beyond Blockchain. I want to move on now, Josh, because you've been a step ahead of a lot of things throughout your career. You were a precious metals guy at Goldman Sachs. You headed up the precious metals research there. You went on to found Gold Money, very successful with that. You've since moved on from Gold Money. The next thing, as I understand it, that you're looking at is the commodity exchange landscape. Now, as a member of NYMEX, you don't want to get me started on what's wrong with commodity exchanges, because I won't shut up for an hour. So what in your mind is wrong with the current landscape of commodity exchanges? And what is ABEX Technologies about? What are you doing in order to change that landscape?
Great. No, I appreciate that. Yeah. And I have to be a little bit careful because we're in a bit of a regulatory blackout and obviously some very big industry players that we want to challenge. So I can't really get into all of the details. But yes, I mean, my view is, you know, essentially the increasing digitization of commerce in general. We think that trend is not going to slow down anytime soon. And so if you look at something like the development of ICE that kind of came out of nowhere to challenge the NYMEX at the time and the old London oil pits and so forth, it really was a mixture of you know, new big changes in global energy combined with big changes in technology. And I think we have both of those conditions right now. Big changes in technology and digitization for all the things that we were just talking about, and big changes in energy markets with what's happening with U.S. shale and U.S. energy exports and the sort of the reordering of global energy supply chains that have been taking place the last 5-6 years and will continue over the next 10. So yeah, I believe the opportunities are right to create a new exchange, and we're basing ours in Singapore, which is also another macro trend of commodity markets increasingly moving east. And so yeah, I mean, I'd say that's the overall landscape. But yeah, I mean, if you look at what's happened in COMEX the last few weeks, if you look at what's happening in a number of commodity markets that have been quite dislocated from fundamentals, I think there's always room for improvement to serve the physical industry. And that's our view. We're not there to serve the financial industry, but to serve the physical industry in really needing true buyer and seller of last resort type markets. So yeah, that's probably as much as I can say right now. But yeah, we think there's a huge, huge white space there.
Well, I look forward to getting you back on the show as this project evolves some, and at some point when you're at liberty to tell us all the details. I can't wait to find out what kind of technology innovations ABEX is going to bring forward to advance the state of the art beyond what we have with the existing exchanges. Meanwhile, Josh, please give our listeners your Twitter handle and how they can follow your work for people who want to keep up with what you're doing.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, I'm just at Josh Crumb, JOSHCRUMB on Twitter. Again, I'm quite active and try to post anytime updated models and that sort of thing. Again, I'm building businesses, so I'm not obviously doing full-time research or anything, but generally in short bursts and when there's interesting things happening in macro, I'll usually show up.
Fantastic. Josh, we look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message. This episode of Macro Voices was sponsored by my own vacation rental on the coast of Maine. It's a 5-acre oceanfront family compound with a deep water dock, two separate residences, two kitchens, and 8 king and queen bedrooms. But with all the pull-out sofas and bunk beds, we can actually sleep upwards of 30 people in a pinch. You couldn't imagine a better safe haven to ride out the COVID-19 crisis than this property. It's extremely rural. You couldn't ask for better social distancing. And it features sunsets over the ocean and has a great big rec room with a pool table, home theater, and super fast 100 megabit cable internet to keep you connected to both Netflix and financial markets. I'd like to find a tenant for the duration of the COVID crisis. This property would be ideal for someone with a big family who wants to get out of New York City and ride the crisis out in the countryside. To be clear, this property is currently booked in July and August, so I'd have to renegotiate with my current reservations, but I don't think that would be too hard given the circumstances. Now, this is a big place, 5 acres of oceanfront, 2 residences, and accommodations for up to 30 people. So it's not cheap, $1,000 a night during high season. But if your family can afford to live in New York City or Boston, you can probably afford to get out of the city for this crisis, which I strongly recommend. If you're interested, please email me via info@macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Josh on the show. It's always great to have some rational kind of a perspective on gold and just what are some of the real drivers behind gold prices and how to model it all.
Patrick, I couldn't agree more. Josh is a super guy. And again, folks, we're going to be bringing you more and more precious metals content on Macro Voices in coming weeks. Let's move on now to our post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says Big Picture Trading Chart Book. Patrick, as we dive in here on page 2, you're showing the S&P chart and basically the big sell-off that we had, 36% in 32 days. You had projected that maybe we would see a bear market rally up to a 50% Fibonacci retrace, which would be around 2,800. Now, I noticed that it looks like it's starting to roll over, and we got almost exactly to a 38.2% Fib retrace. Do you think that was it, or do you think we're still headed up to 2,800 before the bear market rally is over?
Right. So the key to this chart is that I'm not actually forecasting that that will play out this way. What my goal here is simply by me overlaying that, it'll be fun for us in the coming post games to just kind of see how much the analog plays out into how the price action develops. It's never going to be the same, nor is it a forecast, but it's just going to be interesting. And the point really behind it is that it is very likely that the bear market is not over. And it's interesting, there's no shortage of very well-known people out there that are in that same camp. We should have David Rosenberg come back onto the show in the coming weeks or something too, because he's also in that camp. And really what it is that when you have such an overextended market, you're going to have a retrace. It's going to be a bounce. It's just so oversold that the market naturally backfills the move. And really at this stage, it's will we see 2,800? I still think that there's room for us to have one more surge in the coming week or two that could potentially go as high as 2,800. But really, I'm not going to deviate from your view, which is that there's another leg in this bear market coming very likely in the coming weeks.
Well, something that occurs to me, Patrick, after watching today's action in crude oil is, you know, maybe part of President Trump's motive, maybe he's actually not so crazy as to believe the nonsense that he tweeted. Maybe it was a little bit of a intentional flub where he knew that that tweet was going to pump the oil market. We're coming into what everybody knows is kind of going to be the hardest 2 or 3 weeks of the COVID-19 crisis. Maybe what the president's trying to do is pump markets up so that they've got further to fall as we get through the worst of the crisis. And maybe that's what he tried to do with the oil market today. Now, if that is his motive, presumably he might be trying to do something to get the stock market up another leg too. So maybe that 2,800 will still happen.
Right. And so let's move on to chart three, page three, where we have the crude oil chart. And, you know, this is where I want you to do a little bit of talking in terms of explaining how this also works from you, because you're the one that trades oil markets far more than I do. But when a lot of retail investors and listeners engage a crude oil chart or look at that chart, they often associate it with a stock chart, something like Apple or an index, like a SPY, and then they assume that wherever the price is and you buy it, then you have all the upside from there. And they don't understand the dynamic of how futures markets have monthly expiries. And these charts are often showing just the spot price, which is the front month oil contracts. And the contangos in the curve, which we'll talk about in the upcoming charts, actually influence whether or not you make money. Like, you basically would need a very big percentage move in a very short period of time on that front month contract in order for that chart to show that gain there. And so we have on here showing that May, June, July, August, and September oil contracts. You can see it goes $24.5 to $27.5 to $29.5 to $30.5 to $31.5 on those oil contracts. And each one of them are moving at different rates of change. Like, for instance, when we see Donald Trump sending out that tweet, the front month spot oil is actually popped 4.25 on this chart, but yet the September contracts are up barely $2, right? So what is it that our listeners need to understand about this, and how do you always approach it?
Yeah, we've gotten a huge number of inquiries, whether it be emails or Twitter or what have you, with people saying, okay, you know, $20, this has got to be an incredible buying opportunity. Okay, maybe it's going to get down to 15, maybe it's going to get down to 10, but I don't care. I can afford to buy it for 20. I know it's going back to 40 in the next couple of years. I know I'm going to double my money. Well, the thing is, you don't double your money in commodity markets. If you buy at 20 and the price goes to 40, it doesn't mean you made $20. Even though it kind of feels like you should have. On page three, you see that the May, June, July, August, and September contracts are quoted. And the last trade price is showing you that, you know, each of these different one-month contracts has a different price. It's a lot easier to see this if we move on first to slide four. This shows you what the term structure usually looks like. So the leftmost yellow dot there at the very top of the chart, that would be the current expiring futures contract, what we call the front month. Then the next dot next to it is the next month after that, and the next month and so forth. Once you get 2 or 3 months into it, generally speaking, the prices get lower and lower. There's a discount as you go further out in the curve. That condition is called backwardation, and it tends to be the most common shape of the crude oil futures market. What we have when the market sells off dramatically is a situation called contango or super contango, which is just a very exaggerated contango. Moving on to slide number 5, that's the same curve, but you see what's happened is the front month has sold all the way off to $20. The very next month is like $4 higher, and the next month after that is another $3 higher. What that means is that if you buy that thing for $20, at the end of the month, you're going to have to roll it forward, and you end up giving up $3 or $4 of price. So now you've rolled into the new contract. The price went from $20 to $24, but you didn't make anything on that. You're flat. And then a month later, it goes from $24 to $27. You still didn't make anything because each time that you roll forward, you're losing that contango between the first and second month. Now, a lot of people have said, wait a minute, that might be true in the futures market, but if I'm buying through an ETF, what does it matter? I've just, you know, there's only one price for the ETF.
So, Eric, when I look at this deep contango curve that we see on the oil structure, it reminds me a lot of, obviously, the VIX futures, the volatility, and I always trade in contango that have the negative carry as the somebody who is long volatility has to continuously be rolling and is being essentially taxed for being long volatility. So a lot of people ask that question, you know, well, I'm just going to avoid having to deal with futures and I'll just buy the oil ETF. And that's where a lot of people don't get that those oil ETFs are rolling those futures inside those ETFs, right? And so what we have on page 6 is I overlaid the crude oil chart, which is the candles, and then we overlaid two ETFs, which one is the USO, which is the unleveraged United States oil fund, and then the leveraged ProShares Ultra crude oil contract. And the point of looking at this chart in 2019 is it's showing the tracking during a period when there's backwardation. That's why we had that November 2019 chart that we were showing, is it was showing that in backwardation, in fact, they can pretty well track oil in half decently throughout this period, right? What we find, though, is that, and like you were referencing earlier, Eric, is that on page 7, when we go back to when in 2016, when we saw that huge contango in oil as crude oil crashed down to $26 a barrel back then, as soon as that contango appeared in the curve, all of these ETFs materially underperformed the actual price of crude oil because they are rolling those futures in there, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if all of this business about rolling contracts is confusing anybody, a simpler way to think about it is this. In order for you to buy oil, you got to have a tank to store the oil in. And the cost of that storage is reflected by the contango in the market, the difference between one price and the next. Somebody has to pay that storage fee. And when we get to a crisis like this, the storage is at a super high premium in price, and it's the storage cost that's killing you. Now, if you buy the ETF does all of the fancy footwork of the trading, but they still suffer those same losses. The point is, you can't buy $20 oil now and wait till the oil price is $40 and have doubled your money. It's actually possible to wait till the oil price is doubled and to have lost money. Now, that's probably an extreme case, but it has really tricked a lot of people. They thought they were going to double or triple their money. The oil price doubled or tripled, but they only made 15 or 20%. It's called tracking error, and it's inherent to any ETF that tracks the price of a physical commodity, and it's particularly pronounced in a situation like this where crude oil is reached a super contango condition. And finally, moving on to slide 8, folks, don't forget you can get a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Just go to bigpicturetrading.com and sign up for your free trial.
All right, Eric, now let's move on. I've been waiting all show to get that update from you on the COVID-19. So what's going on? What's new?
Well, Patrick, we broke 1 million cases and 50,000 deaths today. So two big, important psychological milestones there. Good news, if there is any here, is Italy and maybe also France appear to be finally starting to peak in terms of new infections. That's new infections. That doesn't mean the crisis is over. The crisis still goes on for a few more months, and the peak in deaths will come several weeks later. But at least there's a light at the end of the tunnel for Italy. The worst is still to come for the rest of the world, and particularly the United States. The next 2 to 3 weeks is when the exponential acceleration occurs until we finally reach the point of peak infections, which should come mid-month for New York City, a little bit later in the month for the rest of the United States and for most other countries in the world. The crisis is going to continue for several months after the peak, but at least markets will have a light at the end of the tunnel. When we see that the virus has peaked in terms of new infections, we're going to be facing, unfortunately, a completely overwhelmed hospital system and the need to triage patients. Potentially, that's going to lead to that reflexive feedback loop that causes the case fatality rate to increase dramatically after the healthcare system is completely overwhelmed. But at least we'll know there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We've reached the peak level of infections, and it's a matter of time until it gets better. The ongoing crisis, though, I think that we're going to realize is bigger than most people have expected. So a lot of these V-shaped recovery charts floating around where they're anticipating what's going to happen in terms of oil demand or in terms of economic activity, and they have this giant V-shaped chart that centers on mid-April. So they appear to be picking the target for peak infections and saying, okay, there's going to be, you know, a drag until we get to peak infections, then it's all going to get better. Wait a minute. Why would you expect it to get better? When we have peak infections, we have an overwhelmed healthcare system. We have a lot of people that are very sick. We have people dying. We have an economy that's shut down and needs to stay shut down for several more weeks. So at least when we get to the point where we're not just to peak infections, but we've really got new infections under control, like Fauci said, I think today, when there are no more new infections, that's when we can reopen the economy. But it's not going to be mid-April. It's going to be well into May before we get to that point. So I think everybody that's expecting a V-shaped recovery on asset prices, on demand for energy and so forth, is going to be surprised. I think it's more likely to be a U-shaped recovery. There's more and more news coming out, Patrick, that China's recovery is faltering. It looks like they may have tried to restart everything in China too soon, and now they're seeing a recurrence of new infections. So they tried to do exactly what President Trump is promising to do, get the economy back online as soon as possible, and it looks like it's starting to blow up in their face. My own greatest concerns in this crisis, Patrick, have shifted now from the virus itself to the response to the virus, maybe leading to some really scary international conflicts. The last couple of days, a blame game has erupted in the U.S. political machine, where all of a sudden, they're blaming China for everything. Frankly, folks, the U.S. has badly botched its response to the virus. Yes, it's absolutely true that China has not been truthful about its cases and so forth, but we all knew that. The U.S. government has done a horrible job of responding to data that it's had since January and that has been very well known. I think as it's blowing up in their face, the Trump administration doesn't want to admit they screwed up, so now it's going to be China's fault. I think that scapegoating China, even though it's true that China is guilty for sure, 100% guilty of fabricated statistics and understating the number of cases and infections and deaths that they had, they did all that stuff, it's true. But to scapegoat them for the United States' botched response to this is really, really dangerous. We have to remember that China is not Afghanistan. It's not Iraq. If we get into a shooting war with China, we're dealing with an adversary that literally has the nuclear capability to destroy the United States at the push of a button. Everything that we used to fear in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, China has enough submarine-launched ballistic missiles to destroy the entire United States. It is widely believed that China has so-called carrier-killer hypersonic missiles that are capable of overcoming defense systems and sinking U.S. aircraft carriers. The last thing that we want to do, whether China lied about their data or not, is to start a war with China. And I really hope that this blaming China doesn't escalate to the point where these words eventually lead to hostility between these superpowers, because I think it could get really scary. And to be sure, it's the United States' response, which has been embarrassing. There was just a governor, I forget which state, today tweeting, saying there's new news that it's possible for there to be asymptomatic transmission with this virus. And they say that the news has only come out in the last 24 hours. Look, you heard about that on Macro Voices, along with a cogent explanation of why it was so important and why it dramatically increased the risk of widespread contagion back on the January 30th episode of this podcast. It's not new news. And people in our government are acting just astonishingly incompetently in terms of their understanding of this situation. The event that's about to happen to the United States is one of our own making. It was our government's botched response to known information. Yes, China lied, but that's not the reason this is about to go as badly as it's going to go. It's going to go this way because we screwed up, not because China lied. Finally, I just want, and those are my opinions. I certainly respect the prerogative of many listeners to disagree. I respect your right to your own opinions. I hope that everyone, though, regardless of whether we agree or disagree on the fault of the U.S. government in this crisis, will join me in saluting the true heroes of the day, which without a doubt are our healthcare workers who are facing an incredible challenge. They don't have the personal protective equipment that they need, and they're risking their lives in order to save ours. So if there are any healthcare workers in your life, please do everything that you can to support them.
Well, thanks for the update, Eric. For our listeners, we're going to continue doing this coronavirus update always here in the post game at the end of the show.
This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
In the Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the charts we discussed in the postgame. Also a link to an article from David Rosenberg that there's only a 20% chance that we've hit a bottom on the stocks, as well as an article from Jesse Felder titled Got Gold. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.